It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll talk to the author of the new cookbook, Crip Up the Kitchen, Tools, Tips, and Recipes for the Disabled Cook. First, the White House last week released the first ever national plan to fight anti-Semitism. The plan comes after a huge increase in anti-Semitic crime over the last 5 years. 2022 was the third time in 5 years where the number of anti-Jewish hate crimes was the highest ever recorded. The FBI reports that although Jews make up just 2.4% of all Americans, they're the victims of over 60% of all religiously motivated hate crimes. The alleged perpetrator of the horrific Tree of Life synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh in 2018 is on trial this week for the killing of 11 worshipers with 6 others wounded. We're talking now about the new official White House strategy to counter anti-Semitism. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this White House strategy? What steps would you want to see to counter anti-Semitism? Do you encounter anti-Semitic language bias in your daily life online? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Chad Goldberg is a professor at the Department of Sociology and faculty affiliate at the Center for Jewish Studies at UW-Madison. He's the author of books including Modernity and the Jews in Western Social Thought. Chad, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here.
Chad, from what you've seen in this plan, what are your reactions to the many different steps the White House is taking?
Well, I have to say that my impression of the national strategy that was released is overall very positive. I think it's well organized. It's well thought out. It is a comprehensive kind of plan. And I particularly like the fact that this is the first of its kind. I like that this is an approach that emphasizes that anti-Semitism is not just a threat to Jews, but is a threat to democracy and American values. And I like that it's a plan, a strategy that calls for what they say or what they describe as a whole of society approach. So not just the government, but really a kind of all hands on deck approach.
Before we look into some of the details, can you talk about the need for a plan like this? I gave some of the big picture statistics. What can you talk about the scope of the problem we're trying to tackle here?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you summed it up very well. I mean, what we are seeing in recent years is a marked increase in anti-Semitic incidents in the United States. It's very troubling. We know that from multiple sources. One of those is the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, which is a civil rights organization that was established more than a century ago to fight anti-Semitism and other forms of bigotry. They monitor anti-Semitic incidents in the U.S., including assaults, vandalism, and harassment. And they and their reports, their annual reports, they have documented a sharp rise in anti-Semitic incidents since 2014, really. The rise continued into 2015. It surged in 2016, particularly after November when Donald Trump was elected president. It continued into 2017. The number of incidents fell slightly in 2018, but rose again in 2019. That was another record-breaking year. Again, incidents declined slightly in 2020, but then reached another all-time high in 2021 that exceeded even the 2019 levels. The most recent report for 2022 shows a 36% jump from the previous year. It's the third time in 5 years that the total has been record-breaking, has been the highest number ever recorded. In addition to the ADL, you've also got the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which tracks hate crimes. This is not exactly the same thing. It's a narrower category, obviously. But the pattern is roughly consistent with what we see in the ADL reports. The number of anti-Jewish hate crime incidents decreased steadily for some years from 2011 through 2014. That's a trend that the ADL welcomed. But anti-Jewish hate crime incidents started to increase in 2015. It rose again in 2016 and spiked about 37% in 2017. They fell a little in 2018, but then jumped again in 2019. And they fell again in 2020, though they remained higher than levels in the first half of the decade. So you're seeing this from multiple sources. I should add that the pattern or the trends in Wisconsin mirror trends at the national level. We know that from the reports of the Jewish Community Relations Council of the Milwaukee Jewish Federation. So this is something that is happening in our own state as well as nationwide.
All right, a huge question, maybe not easy to answer. Why? Why this resurgence in recent years in anti-Semitism, no matter how we're measuring it?
Yeah, that is a great question. I think as with most social phenomenon, there's not just one cause. There are multiple causes at work. One of the things that I think is probably helping to drive this, we are at a point in history where there are a number of changing social conditions that various groups in our society perceive to be a threat, somehow a threat to their power, a threat to their status. So there is anxiety about growing ethno-racial diversity in America as it transitions from a kind of solid majority white population to a nation without a clear ethno-racial dominant group. We see anxiety about the decline and the percentage of Americans who self-identify as Christian. From 2007 to 2021, we see a decline, a marked decline from 78% of Americans who self-identify as Christian to 63%. There are other things at work. My colleague, Myra Marks Ferry, has argued that changes in marriage and the family have generated a crisis of masculinity in the U.S. and Europe. So it's a time of a lot of social changes, changes that can be perceived as threatening to many groups, that create anxiety, that's fertile soil for anti-Semitism to grow in. And I think on top of that, you've got decreasing public trust in government and in social institutions. This is actually something that the U.S. National Strategy to Counter Anti-Semitism draws attention to. I think it's important. And of course, everybody is aware that there's been a rise in and a spread of misinformation. These are really fertile conditions for a growth of anti-Semitism. I think as people are looking for an explanation and looking for someone or something to blame for changes in conditions that they see as threatening.
Talking to sociologist Chad Goldberg from UW-Madison, looking at a new White House plan to deal with a recent surge in anti-Semitism. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences, 800-642-1234. Chad, you mentioned misinformation going on around there. One of the main parts of this White House plan involves education on anti-Semitism and Jewish American history. Can you talk about what we might see there, why that could potentially help?
Yeah, absolutely. As an educator myself, I think this pillar, this one of four pillars of the strategy, is quite important. It's a pillar that includes, of course, school-based education, but also improving education outside the classroom. And this is a national strategy that also highlights the importance of supporting social research on anti-Semitism and its impact on American society. As a sociologist, of course, I think that's very, very important. I have to say that the points that are raised in the strategy are in some ways quite shocking. It's shocking that in a survey of Holocaust knowledge among millennials and Gen Z Americans, most didn't know what Auschwitz was or didn't know that 6 million Jews were murdered in the Holocaust. And this level of ignorance, I think, really opens the door for the kinds of inappropriate comparisons that we've seen between things like public health measures in the Holocaust. It opens the door to Holocaust inversion, a phenomenon where Jews are cast in the role of the new Nazis or are compared to Nazis somehow. So it's important for people to learn about this, to know about this. And I should add that the Holocaust, of course, as important as it is the culmination of a long history mm-hmm. of violent anti-Semitism. People should know about that. I could talk more about that, but one other thing maybe I'll mention about the educational component. This is a component that stresses the importance of educating Americans about anti-Semitism, about its threats to American society and democracy, not just to American Jews, but also, and I appreciated this about the strategy as well, the educational component has to do with teaching people about Jewish American heritage, about Jewish contributions to American life, culture, politics. I think that's important too. Otherwise, we get a kind of skewed and distorted view of Jewish history.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Lisa is with us in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi. Hi. A couple months ago, I came across the statistic that in Wisconsin alone, there's been a 500% increase in anti-Semitic acts since 2017. And in light of that, it becomes even more disturbing when you consider that the GOP-controlled legislature here in Wisconsin wants the UW to end, or they're defunding their Office of Diversity and Inclusion.
Lisa, thanks for the call. Do you see a connection there, Chad?
I do, yeah. I think that's an important point. And I should point out here that the national strategy calls for addressing anti-Semitism in schools, K-12 schools, and on college campuses. And of course, as I think Lisa is suggesting, as she's pointing to, one way that we might do that is to integrate anti-Semitism into campus DEIA programs, diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility programs. That's something that the national strategy specifically calls for. And I think it's a good idea, at least in places where those programs are not being dismantled by Republicans in office. And in fact, I'm attending a conference in Washington, D.C. next week to discuss how to do that more effectively. So where that can be done, I think it's an important strategy or an important tool for countering anti-Semitism.
Thanks for the call, Lisa. We're talking about the White House plan to fight anti-Semitism released last week. Chad Goldberg stays with us, professor at the Department of Sociology and faculty affiliate at the Center for Jewish Studies at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think can be done, could be done to reverse the normalization, apparently, of anti-Semitism? What responsibility do you think social media companies have in this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation about the first ever national plan to fight anti-Semitism released by the White House last week. Chad Goldberg is a professor at the Department of Sociology and faculty affiliate at the Center for Jewish Studies at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about anti-Semitism and its history in the United States? Thoughts, solutions to share? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Tina is with us in Kenosha. Tina, hello.
Hi, how you doing? Yeah, I have a couple of questions. Well, number one, I'd like to say that I know the state of Wisconsin has required in world history to be taught two Holocausts, and one of them is required is, or two, I'm sorry, genocides, and one of them has to be the Holocaust. And the other, which I think is can be applauded about the state of Wisconsin. And the second one is, for instance, in Israel with the Palestinians and the Jewish people there, the fighting. And if you're pro-Palestinian, I feel, this is my thing, because I don't like what's happened to the Palestinian people because of what they're doing over there. Anyways, that to me, that's not being anti-Semitic, you know, as far as freedoms or, you know, rights and liberties and that kind of avenue.
Tina, thanks for the call. Tina is right. There is, as of 2021, I think, a mandate on some education related to the Holocaust. To Tina's observation, Chad, about, you know, can you be pro-Palestinian without being considered anti-Semitic? The questions around Israel enter into this debate and this discussion a lot.
Yes, they certainly do. One of the ways that you see that appear in the national strategy is in the brief discussion about definitions of anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. And the strategy alludes to at least two definitions. So one is the International Holocaust Remembrance Association definition. And then the strategy also mentions an alternative definition, the Nexus document, which is a definition associated with Ken Stern and the Bard Center for the Study of Hate out of Bard College in New York. And the background for that is that there's been some controversy about the International Holocaust Remembrance Association. Some people are worried or fear that it's a definition that could be used to silence criticism of Israel or to restrict free speech. And so others have tried to come up with alternative definitions. I will say that my own view as a sociologist who studies anti-Semitism is that the IHRA definition is useful and I think quite tame. What it says is that targeting the state of Israel, conceived as a Jewish collectivity, might be a manifestation of anti-Semitism. It gives examples, and it says you should make a judgment according to the context. And this is important. Many people forget this about the definition. It says that criticism of Israel, similar to that leveled against any other country, cannot be regarded as anti-Semitic. And I think Tina would certainly agree with that last point. So it's a useful definition, although of course not a substitute for expertise and scholarship and so on. And again, these definitions are guidelines. They're not meant to be legally binding, and they require some attention to context. I think that the strategy probably made a smart move in not embracing one definition over the other. They sort of sidestepped this debate. I think that's probably a good idea, because otherwise they could have gotten bogged down in precisely how you define it, which would really detract from the main object here, which is to counter anti-Semitism and to restore a kind of healthier situation in society.
Thanks for that call, Lisa. Lori is with us now in Verona. Lori, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about my experience with anti-Semitism. I used to teach in the Middleton Cross Plains area schools, and outside of my classroom, a student spray painted in red, "Die Juden, die," and a swastika. And my vice principal at that time responded to me, "Well, you're not that religious, are you?"
And you are Jewish yourself, Lori?
Yes, I am. And I had just had my daughter, and Juden is plural for Jew.
Mm-hmm. Lori, I am so sorry that that happened. And this is something, unfortunately, we are seeing out there. Chad, I think, according to the numbers, Lori is not alone, more often than not.
Yeah, that's unfortunately true. I wish this was an isolated case, but what we're seeing here is a pattern of this kind of thing. And I think Lori makes a very good point. You don't have to be religiously observant to be targeted by anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism doesn't generally distinguish between religiously observant Jews and Jews who are secular. Many people don't really sort of understand this. They don't understand that many Jews are Jewish by ethnicity, by culture, are not necessarily involved in Judaism as a religion. That doesn't make them any less Jewish, and it doesn't make this kind of anti-Semitic incident any less painful.
Thanks for sharing that with us, Lori. I appreciate it. Chad, I want to dig into something we've just touched on briefly, conspiracy theories. They spread very easily. They cross national boundaries on the internet now. Of course, they've been around long before the internet, and it seems like any given conspiracy theory is 1 to 2 steps away from anti-Semitism. Can you talk about the role of normalization of conspiratorial thinking?
Yeah, I can sort of do this in two ways. I mean, so the normalization aspect, this is another one of the pillars of the national strategy to counter anti-Semitism. I think this is a really important element. I think it's very, very important. I think in a divided and polarized political environment, what we see is an increasing reluctance for people to call out anti-Semitism or anti-Semitic conspiracies when those kinds of things emerge within their own political camp. People are more than happy to call it out in the opposing political camp, but very reluctant to call it out in their own. And I will give you just two examples to illustrate what I mean. So I don't want to pick on either side of the political spectrum here. So I'll give you one from each side. When U.S. Representative Ilhan Omar said that Israel has hypnotized the world while doing evil, that congressional support for Israel is all about the Benjamins, which is to say about money, and that American supporters of Israel push for allegiance to a foreign country, most progressives defended her, and some rejected the charge of anti-Semitism out of hand, even though those remarks earned her the praise of former Ku Klux Klan Grand Wizard David Duke. On the other side of the political spectrum, just very recently, U.S. Representative Lauren Boebert from Colorado tweeted about this U.S. national strategy to counter anti-Semitism and said, quote, "They want to go after conservatives." There's a history of conservatives purging dangerous elements from their movement, elements like anti-Semites, racists, conspiracy theorists, and so on. William F. Buckley Jr. and the National Review played an important role in that policing. When today right-wing legislators like Boebert are unwilling to do this policing, when they are no longer able or willing to separate anti-Semitism from conservatism, then that's normalizing anti-Semitism. That's encouraging and promoting or fostering an environment in which these kinds of conspiracy theories can grow.
And another part of the plan, one of the saddest parts in some ways, we've got this trial going on this week in that horrific Tree of Life shooting in Pittsburgh a few years back. Part of the plan is to improve safety and security for Jewish communities. Can you spend our last minute talking about the importance of that part of the plan?
Yes, this is obviously the most urgent pillar. The most urgent task is to protect life and safety. It requires effective police work that is discussed in some detail in the national strategy. But I would add that it's not only police work, although that's the most important element here. The national strategy also calls for things like improved data collection, again, going back to the importance of social research and anti-Semitism and supporting good, rigorous social research. It also calls for the expansion of community-based violence prevention efforts, which I think is quite important. And it recognizes anti-Semitism as a transnational threat, which I think is also really valuable about this strategy. It includes a call to address foreign support for anti-Semitism in the U.S. We know that anti-Semitism is a problem in many places, not only the United States, and we know that anti-Semites have ties, connections, they communicate with each other across national borders. They cite each other's manifestos and so on. So recognizing the transnational dimension of anti-Semitism as a threat, I think, is important and necessary to improve safety and security for Jewish communities.
And Chad, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Chad Goldberg is a professor at the Department of Sociology and faculty affiliate at the Center for Jewish Studies at UW-Madison. He's the author of books including Modernity and the Jews in Western Social Thought, and he talked to us today about the White House strategy to fight anti-Semitism, that plan released last week. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Our guest wants to improve the cooking experience for people with disabilities or other accessibility issues. We'll get lots of advice. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin lawmakers are still working on their budget priorities for public education. A school district superintendent joins us for a look at the needs of K-12 schools. Now it's Food Friday. Our next guest loved to cook, and then he couldn't. Developing pain condition took him out of the kitchen, and he's not alone. For people with disabilities, chronic conditions, long-term illnesses, the impacts of aging, and more, the kitchen can be a much more challenging and less joyful space. But in a new book, our guest says he found ways to get back into cooking and shares lots of advice learned along the way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does this sound like your story or a family member, friend, someone you're close to? How does living with a disability or other mobility issue, say, impact what you eat, how you prepare meals for yourself or others? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jules Sherrod is an author, writer, and food photographer based in British Columbia. His new book is called Crip Up the Kitchen, Tools, Tips, and Recipes for the Disabled Cook. Jules, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I summed up your story very briefly there. Can you talk a little more about your love of cooking, the joy of cooking, and why it was important for you to recapture that feeling?
I grew up in a family where food and cooking was always central, especially around family gatherings and community. I grew up in a lot of communities, especially communities of new Canadians who brought their very heavy food cultures with them when they came to Canada and was really immersed in that. And so cooking was always a very central part to my life growing up. And then I became disabled in my early 20s, but it progressed to the point where cooking was pretty much cut out of my life for a good 5 years. I couldn't do it at all. It was torture. It was excruciating. And it wasn't until I found tips and tools to be able to start reclaiming that part of my life that I realized how much missing it was an issue. Like I had this gray cloud over my life or in my brain, so to speak. It wasn't quite a depression, but it was still like everything was dull is the best way I can describe it. And I didn't realize how much part of my soul was dimmed until I was able to reclaim the ability to cook. So it was huge for me, absolutely phenomenal. And as I started to develop recipes with disability in mind and be able to reconnect with certain recipes that were so important to me personally and felt that joy, then it became a bit of a mission to be able to give people that joy too, who where food is so central, not just for like having to eat and stay alive, but also for a mental health reason.
And here's a line that really struck me. The kitchen is the worst room in the house if you are disabled. Can you talk about that a little?
So if you become disabled, it can cost up to $100,000 to do a renovation in the kitchen to make it accessible, because it's not cheap to lower counters, as an example. It's not cheap to widen the clearance between, say, the fridge and the counter if you're a wheelchair user. None of those things are cheap. Other rooms are much more financially feasible to update, like putting a shower rail or whatever, having aids to be able to get out of bed or whatever. All that stuff is, I mean, it's not cheap overall, but it is far more inexpensive than having to make a kitchen accessible. And even kitchens that do have the like new building codes have, you, I think it's like 3 feet or 2.5 feet from the fridge to the counter. But a lot of that time, that clearance is not enough to fit a wheelchair between that and still being able to open up the fridge, or fit a wheelchair safely and being able to open up an oven. Think like all the stuff is by default not designed with disability in mind.
Now, if there is a star of your book, apart from you, Jules, it is the electric pressure cooker, the Instant Pots and other brands in the world. Why, and most of your recipes in the book center around this, why is this such a key tool?
Because of its ease of use and the fact that it doesn't matter what form of disability you have. You just throw a bunch of ingredients into the Instant Pot, you set the time, and you forget about it. You don't have to worry about forgetting what you're doing if you have any type of brain fog or working memory issues. You don't have to worry about forgetting what you're cooking and burning. You don't have to worry about fatigue. You don't have to worry about standing up. You can use the kitchen room in any room in your house, or the Instant Pot in any room of the house. So if you needed to sit down and cook in your living room, you could do that at your couch, as long as you have an extension cord to be able to plug it in. It's very, very versatile and just friendly to you if you know how to use it. That's the biggest stumbling block, is learning how to use it. But once you know how to use it, then you're set for life.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Jules Sherrod about the new book, Crip Up the Kitchen, Tools, Tips, and Recipes for the Disabled Cook. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you need some advice? Do you have some advice to share about cooking with having a particular disability or chronic condition or something that's changed in your cooking as you've aged, maybe? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jules, an interesting part of the cooking planning you talk about is fatigue management. And while disabilities are going to be different from person to person, it's a very common story for people that, you know, you've got a finite amount of energy. Spoons is the example you give. Can you talk about managing our energy spoons and how that factors into cooking?
Yeah, so whether it be a chronic illness, disability, or a pain issue, but even people who are neurodivergent, thinking is very exhausting. So exhausting. Masking, if you're neurodivergent, is exhausting. A lot of people with disabilities, one of their major shared symptoms is chronic fatigue. And people who are able-bodied have cups of energy they can spend throughout the day, and it takes no effort to replenish that cup. those of us where fatigue is one of our main symptoms of our disability, we have spoonfuls of energy that we can spend, and it takes a lot more effort to be able to replenish those spoons. And sometimes it can take a week just to replenish one spoon. So we have to be very mindful with how we use our energy. So I have created a system where you create a chart of activities that you can, you know, you're able to accomplish based off of how many spoons you have. And it takes a while to be able to create a chart that works for you. And I give a chart in the cookbook as an example to work from as a jumping off point. And so my suggestion is that people in the beginning of their day, they assess their body, they figure out how many spoons they have, and then they pick activities based off of that number. They reassess in the afternoon after lunch. And if they are down to one spoon, then they are done. If they have some more spoons to spend, then they can add some more activities. The goal at the end of your day when you reassess a third time is to have one spoon left at least so that you can enjoy the evening and that you're not dying and crashing on the couch once your work day is over. So you have things other than to do other than work. And so the whole concept is to work within your limitations, to recognize that we all have limitations and that is cool. And you actually end up being more productive when you work within those boundaries instead of pushing yourself to the point where you're getting injured and to the point where you're having to spend a week in bed because you did too much. And then all the recipes are organized based off of that concept. So the very first recipe takes the least amount of energy and spoons to make, and it's all the way through to the very last recipe, which takes every single ounce of energy you have. And you do that when you have like a very extra burst of energy and you want to do something very special. And most of the recipes fall into like low effort, low energy category.
Let's visit one of those recipes. You shared a few with us. We've got them at WPR.org/Food Friday, an electric pressure cooker, butter chicken. Can you tell us a little bit about that recipe?
So butter chicken is a recipe that is relatively new to Indian cuisine. I have the food history to that in the book as well. And a lot of people think it's like a really old dish, and it's not. But the reason why I have it in the book is because it teaches the very basic technique for cooking a curry, and a curry is actually a cooking method and not a flavor. And that's another thing that I explain in the book. Curry means to cook in a gravy. It's often a masala gravy, which means a spicy gravy, but it doesn't have to be a masala based gravy. And so it teaches the basics of cooking a curried dish so that you can, any other curry that you want to do, you can use the method for those other curries as well. Once you learn one curry, you basically know how to make all the curries. So it's just a method or a matter of changing up the spice blends and the ingredients. And it's a favorite, right? Like, who doesn't love butter chicken? And it's like 10 minutes of effort and it's done. Compared to if you were doing butter chicken in the traditional method, traditional being in like air quotes, which you can't see, which can take hours. So it's just one of those things to really show like, you can have this delicious dish, 10 minutes, done. And you also learn how to make other curries in the process.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to author and food photographer Jules Sherrod about his new book, Crip Up the Kitchen, Tools, Tips, and Recipes for the Disabled Cook. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? Have you been using one of the devices we've highlighted so far? We talked about the electric pressure cooker in particular. Do you find that simplifies your cooking? If you have a disability or something else that makes life more difficult for you in the kitchen, have you found solutions, workarounds? Do you need some advice for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with author and food photographer Jules Sherrod. We're talking about his new book called Crip Up the Kitchen, Tools, Tips, and Recipes for the Disabled Cook. If we're talking about you and your experience in the kitchen, would love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you're busy cooking, of course, that's just fine. But the number is 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jules, you talk some about setting up the kitchen in convenient ways to make the flow a little better, short of that $100,000 renovation that you're talking about, that obviously that is not really an option for a lot of us. What are some of your key pieces of advice?
If you have an area in your kitchen that will fit a table, it doesn't have to be a huge table, any size table that is good, prepare food at a table. You can even do this in your dining room as well if you want to use your dining room for something other than primarily an eating room. A lot of families do that now. So have a working table. That's what kitchen tables used to be used for. And your often used appliances and tools and spices you keep on that table right in front of you. It's all about making sure that things are you don't have to go hunting for tools and pulling things out, which again expends energy and can increase pain levels. You can have like extra carts and stuff beside you or directly behind you, all within arm's reach to put things that won't fit on that table. You don't put things away that you are using often, and a lot of people will be like, well, that's cluttered. I'm like, no, like this is about making sure that your kitchen works for you and that you are not hurting yourself working in your kitchen. So that's my biggest tip, is just create a work area wherever you are able to do that has those most often used tools and staple, like shelf-safe ingredients at reach.
You also have an approach in the book to meal planning, Jules, and you, I think, had the same reaction to some of the meal planning advice out there. It's like, it doesn't seem like it's that much less work the way these people want us to do it. You've got a different method. Could you share that with us?
Yeah. And every time I talk about this, people are like, are you daft, Jules? I'm like, no, trust me, it works. So I look at meal planning at a month in advance, and automatically people are like, come on now, a month? I'm like, yes, it's really easy if you just take an extra like 10, 15 minutes to kind of plan. You pick 8 to 9 recipes that your favorite recipes that you know that no matter how you're feeling, you will like safe foods, recipes that you know you will enjoy. And then you figure out what those staple ingredients are, like the big ingredients are for those recipes. And you spend time every 2 weeks chopping those recipes in the quantities that they're used, and then you freeze them and you pull them out when you need to. And with the Instapot, that's another great thing, is you can cook things from frozen. You just need to add a couple more minutes to the time under pressure. Super, super easy. And it's also any recipes that call for like half of something, double that recipe. So that like all of my fridge always has like 8 containers of 1 cup of onions, which is like 1 medium onion. And so like any recipe that I've ever come across that says use half an onion or half a cup of onion, I'm like, no, I'm doubling the recipe and doing 1 cup. So I'm not freezing ingredients in different sizes. It's all standardized. There's no thinking. And then I always have prepared ingredients on hand in a way that's not going to end up in compost because I've gone bad in my fridge because I just don't have the energy to cook. And if I am feeling with like I have extra energy, then I always have something ready to go. And also doing batch cooking is another big thing. Like I never make something that's only going to be enough for one meal. It's like 8 canned, like pressure jarred food canned that go in my cupboards. So I also always have prepared meals ready to go in my pantry.
Talking to Jules Sherrod on Food Friday. His new book is Crip Up the Kitchen, Tools, Tips, and Recipes for the Disabled Cook. I've got a few recipes from Jules at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's check out, Jules, another one of those. Now, a lot of these have personal stories. This one I love. It's one of your church basement memories, the electric pressure cooker hamburger stew.
Yeah, so I love the story of this one. And this is like a medium effort recipe because it takes quite a while to chop all the vegetables that are in it. So I grew up in the United Church of Canada, and there's a women's group called the United Church Women, UCW, that every year put out cookbooks for congregations across Canada to purchase, and that money would go to fund their local church. And people would submit recipes to it. And there were always multiple recipes. Normally, most of them would all come from the province of Saskatchewan for hamburger soup or hamburger stew. And they were all slightly different in different ways. And then I had to, like, it really stuck out to me, like, what is with Saskatchewan and hamburger stew or hamburger soup? And when I did some research, it has to do with the Dust Bowl. Dust Bowl and the Great Depression, and a time where people did not have means, especially farmers. So Saskatchewan is a farm province, and they suffered greatly during the Dust Bowl. And it was something that was cheap and nutritious that they could still feed their families with, even throughout that time. And so that's included in there as well. It's very versatile. And you can add whatever veg that you like to it. You can change up the meat from hamburger to like a meatless, like beyond meat. Or you can even use like chicken or turkey if you wanted to, if hamburger isn't your thing. And so, yeah, it's just really delicious and versatile.
Again, you can find that recipe linked at WPR.org/Food Friday. Now, Jules, your book is filled with, electric pressure cooker type recipes. There are cookbooks out there. What if people have that favorite thing that they used to make in the oven? Is it pretty easy to convert and make that in Instant Pot or other brand pressure cooker meal?
Yes, and I have a guide in the cookbook how to do both, how to... So with things like in the oven, you can even do cakes in the Instant Pot. You just would put a cake pan on a trivet, put a cup of water to create the steam so it goes under pressure. It makes a very dense, moist cake. But I also have a cake recipe to use in the air fryer to give an example of how you can do cakes in the air fryer. But you can also use your bread machine to make cakes. And I have bread machine recipes as well with cakes. For if you have an air fryer, the oven ones that have a rotisserie are amazing. Then it's basically subtracting 25 degrees plus 20% of the cook time to be able to cook those things that you normally like in the oven in an air fryer. So doing an Instant Pot requires a lot more work. So I'm not sure I can explain it in the time left, but it is in the cookbook. And I think like the number one tip that I can give succinctly is that where a lot of people go wrong and why they don't enjoy their Instant Pot is because they think you can just like do 1-to-1 measurements for fluids from a stovetop recipe to the Instant Pot, not realizing that everything like your veg and your meats are going to add to the liquid content and dilute the flavor of the recipe. So always start with just 1 cup of water, knowing that everything else you add to it that's not a starch is going to add water to the recipe. And then if it's too concentrated for you when it's done, you can always add more water when you're done, but you cannot subtract it when it's over. So it's so start with 1 cup and increase water at the end if you need to.
In just our last minute or so, a half minute or so, Jules, can you offer some encouragement for people in that place where you were when you weren't able to cook, hadn't found these methods, some encouragement to maybe find ways to give it a try again?
It's it is daunting and it is difficult, but it's about finding the little in. If you're not using an Instant Pot yet or other brand, try that. Finding recipes that are really low prep times, 5-10 minutes prep. And it's difficult. It's one of the things I talk about is a lot of the recipes that are out there give unrealistic prep times. They'll say, oh, it takes 30 minutes. And where those of us with mobility issues are still chopping vegetables an hour and a half later. So it's go low, go slow. Listen to your body is number one. If you need to take breaks, then take a break. Don't push through, because that's when things get like painful and ouch, and it just turns into a torture process instead of something that is joyful. And think about ways to unconventional ways of cooking. Like if it's easier for you to cook at a table and all you have is your dining room table, create a little cooking prep area at your dining room table and don't use your kitchen until it's time to like use your stove.
Jules, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Jules Sherrod. We've been talking on Food Friday about his new book. It's called Crip Up the Kitchen, Tools, Tips, and Recipes for the Disabled Cook. You can find a few recipes from Jules over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Stonehenge, the mysterious site from ancient Britain, attracts tourists and puzzles researchers who try to figure out what it was built and used for. Ongoing research says there may be a sound explanation. As reported by the BBC, it's believed that people use Stonehenge for maybe rituals, ceremonial gatherings. No one knows what they were doing, but ongoing research has analyzed the acoustics of the 5,000-year-old structure. Researchers built a scale model of Stonehenge measured in inches, not feet. They did audio tests and found that the stone arches would have amplified sounds made inside the circle, giving them some cool reverb, too. Now they're putting in figures of people to see how a crowd would have changed the sound. One conclusion, the acoustics would have been great for speeches, ceremonial chanting, or a rock concert. Stonehenge, where the demons dwell, where the banshees live. Acoustical news you can use. This is Central Time. Children dance to the pipes of time.